Hello, this is Jan Sanders, and let me thank you for joining us tonight for A Feminist Perspective. This weekly radio broadcast is sponsored by the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center, which is a program and information service of the Dean of Women's Office, 220 Strong Hall. Located in the Women's Resource and Career Planning Center is a large lending library which contains vast amounts of information, news clippings, government documents, magazine articles, research studies, and books pertaining to the many aspects of the women's movement. The goal of this radio program is to provide a forum for women themselves to speak publicly and to help inform other women and men on issues of concern to them. We would like to invite you to come in and browse or take advantage of our resource center in 220 Strong Hall, and to call us tonight to give your comments or questions on this program. Again, the number is 864-4530. Our topic tonight is women and their bodies. We will be exploring the concept of self-help for and by women. We have a panel of three tonight. First of all, Sue Leminska, who works with human sexuality counseling and with self-help here at KU and is a pre-med student. We have Sharon Lee, another pre-med student active with self-help, and both of these women are involved with the Women's Coalition here. And we have Dr. Evelyn Gundell, who serves as the director of the Maternal and Child Health Commission of the State Health Department, and has an appointment as Associate Clinical Professor of Human Ecology at the University of Kansas Medical Center. I think the proper place to begin this evening is actually defining our topic for those in the audience who might not know. What exactly is self-help?
Well, I prefer to call it self-health because as far as I'm concerned, it's an educational device for women to learn about their own bodies and about how to take care of their bodies so that if they have any problems, they'll be able to get help, professional help for it.
What do you do in a self-help group or a session?
Well, usually the way we've worked it in Lawrence is by sort of teaching modules of maybe 4 weeks in succession. And we begin by teaching basic reproductive anatomy and physiology and talking some about hormonal control of the menstrual cycle and probably discussing birth control methods also, how they work, how effective they are, why one method might be more suitable for a person than another method. And then for the women who want to continue, we teach women how to visualize their own cervixes, how to do breast self-examination, and sometimes we go on with individual research in any area that people are particularly interested in. Like Sharon and I did some work with the reproductive cycle of rats for a biology project this semester and worked it in some with our self-help classes too and learned how to do rat hysterectomies and things like that.
Is there any difference between self-help and just basic sex education?
Definitely. I think that with self-health, people are learning more about their internal organs, and especially, I think the cervical examination is the most important part of it, really, because when people learn how to visualize their cervixes, then they can catch infections early. The first stages of gonorrhea and syphilis is an internal thing, that if a woman wasn't watching herself internally, it wouldn't show up for a long time.
Now, when you're talking about visualizing, you're not talking about just imagining, are you? You're talking about
actually
looking.
Using a speculum and a mirror and a flashlight by reflecting the light of the flat pipe while inserting the speculum vaginally and then then reflecting the light off of a mirror, a woman can all by herself look at her own cervix.
I think what we've just heard as a definition of self-health or self-help is really a very constructive kind of thing that's happening, because from years in practice and in some of the same kind of activities you all have been involved in sex education and abortion counseling and in pregnancy counseling and use of contraceptives, one of the biggest problems has been lack of real information. And imparting information, the kind that you're talking about, is more than just facts, because a whole range of attitudes are developed mm-hmm. through that process. And it's a really fine educational process in terms of protecting women and helping them to protect themselves.
Mm-hmm. I think a really important factor of the self-help process is that the woman is very much a participant in her own educational process. It isn't passively sitting in a classroom and seeing someone draw an ovaries and a pair of ovaries and uterus on the board. She's helping to educate herself.
It would seem to me that a woman who would take the risk of getting up on the examination table in front of a group and exploring herself, this is a very great risk. It would seem that a woman would already have achieved some level before she could do this.
Yeah, a lot of people are somewhat afraid to do it at first, and we never, of course, require that anybody do it. We never push anybody into it and just suggest that when they feel that they're ready to do it, that will help them with it. But usually we find that once people do get up the nerve to try it, they're really excited by it. And that, you know, they're very glad that at last they get a chance to look at whatever it is that the doctor has been looking at under a sheet for all these years and they never knew what it was before.
Actually, it's a really relaxed atmosphere too. And like Susan was saying, during the first session, we usually don't jump right into the cervical examinations, so that women have a chance to kind of get to know each other a little bit. When we talk about sexuality, we're already talking about very intimate things, so that by the time the second meeting comes around, usually people are ready for it.
And I think this is not a lot different than what we found, you know, years ago in teaching self-examination of the breast.
Mm-hmm.
It was an awkward situation for women, or at least many seemed to feel that it was, even though it was the nurse generally who would first introduce them to the technique, and later the physician who would come in and help them to recognize their own geography, yeah. so to speak, of the breast. And the same thing is what is being attempted here. I think the concern that a lot of us have had has been for the groups in which diagnosis and self-treatment are the result of visualizing the cervix,
mm-hmm.
because obviously there's the rest of the pelvis and the bimanual examination and the feeling and detection of the ovaries and the size of the uterus, and the rest of that can't be determined by visualizing the cervix.
Mm-hmm.
But knowing what the healthy cervix looks like, by golly, is certainly, you know, really one of the first preventive steps, rather than waiting for the kinds of signs and symptoms that we've all been taught to look for, which are really much too late.
Mm-hmm.
When those are detected,
what is it that
problems?
What is it that you can see? What various changes, what various symptoms can be discovered through self-examination?
Well, probably the thing that women find most often is yeast infections, which normally, if you catch them early enough, they're not that serious. You can pretty easily take care of them. Like the doctors prescribe, what is it? I can't remember what it's called. Anyway, there's a prescription that doctors can give you to take care of it real easily. And if a woman knows about it and catches it ahead early enough.
And then there really needs to be a differential diagnosis, because there are other vaginal infections that imitate yeast infection. And that's the really important part. Plus the fact that gonorrheal infection really doesn't cause any different look to a yeast infection.
Mm-hmm.
And it's for one reason, for so many years we've been distressed by not having a way to
detect
it.
Does it cause a different appearance than a normal cervix, a normal vagina?
Gonorrhea?
Yes.
Actually, not. That's been the problem, because the normal inhabitants of the vagina are very much like the normal inhabitants of the mouth. They don't cause you any trouble until weakness is lowered or whatever. In the case of gonorrhea, that means venereal contact. And the secretions are already there, and the gonococci are very difficult to to identify in the past. Now we have a new test for quick identification, and it can be detected by microscope separate from the rest of the vaginal discharge, of a vaginal discharge. But otherwise, if a person has a discharge and has gonorrhea, the pit probably won't be aware of it. It's one reason that we've so often, the epidemiology and discovering gonorrhea has been so difficult for women, whereas with men it's fairly obvious, or it used to be, because now we have a strain of gonorrhea.
Yes, silent gonorrhea.
That is silent and means a very particular kind of an examination for the male that most probably will not go in for unless they're pretty sure they've been exposed.
I have read some things that indicate a woman can determine if she is pregnant or not by the appearance of the cervix. Is that a myth or a truth?
It's a shame that it's done so glibly, and you all might want to join in on this, because really the changes in the cervix don't occur so that they're that noticeable, the increased vascularity and the change in color, until probably 8.5 weeks. And lots of times when you read the description of self-help, it says you can detect yeast, other kinds of vaginal infection, and early signs of pregnancy. And it really isn't quite that early. It would be a little late before you had the vascularity change.
I think that
change.
Self-help groups are just exploring the changes in a normal cervix, which hasn't been done very often before. I know of a woman who was part of a self-help group in Wichita who has been taking excellent slides of cervices stage by stage throughout the monthly cycle, and she's hoping to come up with changes that do occur through a regular cycle that people haven't really been aware of before, because they just have pictures of abnormal cervices and gynecological techs and things like that.
You're right.
So they're hoping to discover things like that, you know, that they can detect early pregnancy by changes in the cervix. I don't know as to what, you know, whether they can validly say that they can do it at this point in time. But we're just trying to see what more we can find out.
I think everything that can be learned about the normal cervix means that you're going to have a healthier individual, since so much of women's diseases are concentrated in the cervix and the vaginal canal, but primarily the cervix due to childbearing and various infections that we talked about. The other thing that concerns me, and I'd like to ask both of you about it, is we frequently hear my colleagues, and in the future your colleagues, who will indicate to a girl that a vaginal discharge is normal. She'll say, you know, I'm having a discharge, and is dismissed with, well, it'll go away, or that's normal. Whereas, a matter of fact, physiologically it isn't normal for a person to have a continuing vaginal discharge. And I think that's part of what could be introduced in self-help. The knowledge of what kind of cervical exudate there might be, so that when it increases, or when it changes in color, or when it becomes bloody, or whatever else, the individual knows that it's time to have something done.
That's one thing we try to teach as much as we can, you know, with the training that we have, is to differentiate between what is a normal amount of discharge and what texture, what color discharge is normal, what indicates an infection or some other type of disorder that should be checked out.
Also with the cervix, because the cervix, you can find sometimes the cervix will have what is called an erosion on it. And if a woman goes to the doctor and the doctor says, well, you have a cervical erosion, and the woman doesn't know what that is, it sounds horrible. But in reality, it may not be. It may, she may need to get it treated, but it probably isn't as bad as it sounds. It's just a kind of a red spot on the cervix.
So are we also recommending that when women are examined, they begin to ask questions about what is being said, and if nothing's being said, ask the doctor, you know, what's going on, and I think it's certainly not inappropriate, and I hope we would begin to help women to recognize this when they are undergoing a normal pelvic examination or routine examination, to ask the doctor to move the mirror where they can see.
I've considered
taking the drape
away.
Yeah.
And the drape taken away.
And let's talk about what we're seeing and feeling. It seems to me an informed patient, a doctor should be very happy to have an informed patient.
Yeah, they're going to be a much healthier patient. I'll be able to.
We may have to pick a few doctors up off the floor.
Yes, I find I agree with you idealistically, but my next question was going to be, Dr. Yandell, what is realistic about your colleagues?
Well, as a matter of fact, there are quite a number of the obstetrician gynecologists as well as general practitioners who do a lot of gynecology and who are already very sensitive to, and what I call, have always been telling doctors. Mm-hmm. As they examine you, they tell you what they're doing, and they ask if you would like to see your cervix. There's the same doctors who let you watch your own delivery. Mm-hmm. And there are a whole group like that, and always have been. There are others who I think perhaps may be in the majority, but I don't think we've really done a poll nationwide yet, who say, you know, and I call those non-telling doctors. They are, does not make them any less competent in what they do, but at the same time, they have a passive patient who needs to be able to say, doc, you know, what's going on. And I think after a while, with enough of that kind of conditioning, that realistically then,
yes.
Jen.
Well, I think that as the non-medical member of this panel, I guess that's my position at this point. And
well,
I know
how do
that
we get this way?
I know that I would feel somewhat apprehensive if the doctor were examining me for bronchitis and would tell me the specific type of inflammation I had in the bronchial tubes. I would not know what to ask him. I'm not aware of the anatomy of my lungs that well, just as I feel I'm not completely in control of my awareness of my entire anatomy. I would feel I don't know what to ask. I don't know if he's giving me a line, how specific he's being.
I think in general, the specificity is all right if the patient feels that what's being said is something that, you know, you really don't understand. Then that's when the next question comes. You know,
what does this mean?
What does this mean? Mm-hmm. And I think most doctors who find that the patient really is interested will go ahead and explain this in terms that are very easy to understand. There are some physicians who say the patient really doesn't want to know. And for some patients, that's true. Mm-hmm. But for many, there are those who would like to ask, but are afraid that when they do, they won't understand what they're told anyway. The kind of thing you just mentioned.
Yes.
But I would hope that what we can do is help to train patients, and I must say this, for men and women patients, to ask questions about whatever examination is being done, if they do have questions about it.
Mm-hmm. I tell people pretty often that they should make up a list of any questions that they might have before they go in for the examination and have it right there so that they don't, if they lose their courage while they're in the examining room, they have that to refer to.
And it's a shame to have to say to lose courage, because
yeah.
I think that's something, it's interesting that our third year medical students a couple of years ago said that the MD-D does not necessarily make a physician, and that that has hung over for a long time. It would be very nice if, although I'm sure physicians that we need to be, in a sense, authority figures, It's an inhibiting factor to the patient many times, and perhaps the patient does not learn as much as they might otherwise. So that some of that, I hope, is changing in the training of medical students at this particular time.
Well, in the interest of education and information, then, what should happen in the ideal examination, a gynecological examination, between a very responsive physician and an interested patient? What would be the procedure?
How about a patient who comes in who's viewed her cervix and has determined that, you know, she thinks she has an infection. So she goes into the doctor's office and tells the physician that she thinks she has an infection. The physician checks, and yes, she does have an infection. And the physician lowers the mirror and removes the cloth so that the woman, you know, can participate in the physician's view of the cervix, and then the woman would then be told what the medication is that's being prescribed,
and how it works.
Exactly how to use it and how it works.
And this is, you know, really very sensible, because it is a patient that has to apply with medication, she's often doing it quite blindly or with an inserter.
Oh, right.
The same way that certain kinds of medications have been prescribed all along. How much better for the patient to know where it's going and what it's going for. I think the same thing is true, and as I mentioned earlier, that male patients deserve the same kind of assistance just because they're, particularly in this case we're talking about genital organs, are all out there to be seen every day, doesn't mean that all of them understand the, you know, their total reproductive and sexual workings. So that a number of young men have joined the movement in the concept of questioning their own physicians about some of their own functions.
This leads me to another question. How did the emphasis of self-help happen to become centered on the female reproductive system? If indeed the issue is a political one, as some of the literature indicates, it's control of one's own body. All right, so I don't know the anatomy of my reproductive system, but neither do I know the anatomy of my respiratory system. Why is the emphasis in that in the one place?
Well, I think Dr. Gundel pointed out a few minutes ago that women oftentimes have, it's common to have infections, you know, in the vagina. And since, as she also pointed out, the men's reproductive genital tract anyway is on the outside, and the women's is inside, I think that's probably the main reason why the emphasis is here. Also perhaps because the women's movement right now is more political than the men's movement.
Well, I would move it back some from the political per se, but I think it's the nature of the examination and the fact that there are very few people who are privy to examine the vagina, and so for this reason it means something very special to most women, and you will find many people who say, oh, I adore my gynecologist, and they really have to work out some kind of an adjustment for themselves of a father figure or some kind of relationship that really isn't a person-to-person relationship, and that's probably what it really ought to be. And I think at least from the women that I've talked with who have really been active in the movement, as you all have been, part of it has been to say, look, I'm another human being, and just because this is my sexual anatomy, which happens to be obscured from me, can I share learning about it, and will you help? And to be able to ask that without feeling intimidated or paternalized or whatever it is that so many women do feel inhibits their asking these kinds of questions and finding out more about themselves.
I think that a major reason why the women's movement has zeroed in on understanding of the reproductive organs is that a misunderstanding of the reproductive organs can vastly change a woman's life by an unwanted pregnancy. All it takes is a very simple misunderstanding, and that can change a woman's identity for some years to come.
The other thing is that women go regularly for examination, because the kinds of lesions that would be that would go unseen are quite dangerous. We're talking about cancer of the cervix and uterus, so that they really are the consumers. They consume a lot more of the medical care system in relation to their genital tract. Part of it that really concerns me is that unless that out of the movement, a really very constructive thing, is what we're talking about here. On the other hand, there's some people who feel that it's very difficult to get into the medical care system, and consequently they're going to take care of themselves, and we're back to the old do-it-yourself care, some of which could be very good, much of which may not, and part of which can be quite dangerous when individuals send off for devices or whatever to use on themselves without the assistance of other people. And since I'm very interested in the preventive aspects, I hate to see us catch up with a crisis after it occurs.
I think it's really important for doctors to be sensitive to the self-help movement right now and to be zeroing in on the needs of women, because if they don't, like you say, it can become a very dangerous thing.
the women will really be will turn away, and that's not constructive. Mm-hmm. If they turn away, then and do their own thing, separate from professional help. And I don't mean that it always has to be the physician. There are nurse clinicians and many paraprofessionals are being developed to help work with a physician. But by moving completely away from this, then in a sense, this doctor feels he does not have to take the responsibility. And consequently, the system won't change.
Mm-hmm.
The constructive part mm-hmm. is the kind that does the educational type of thing in which you all are involved, which I've been involved in, and a number of other women in this state and elsewhere.
All right, we're going to pause now for a brief station break. I'd like to remind you that our telephone number is 864-4530, and we welcome your questions and your comments. And now we'll pause for a brief station break. Good evening. Our topic tonight is self-help, women's bodies and themselves. Our guests are Sue Leminska and Sharon Lee, students at KU in the pre-medical program who are active in human sexuality counseling and the self-help program here, and Dr. Evelyn Gendel, who's with Again, let me remind you, our telephone number is 864-4530, and we welcome your questions. We've been exploring some of the aspects of self-help, and we explored a little bit the political implications of it. Why do you think the self-help movement came about? It's fairly recent, as I understand, in the feminist movement, and what reasons would you give for its emergence at this time?
Well, it has been around. Yes, the primary moving force is Carol Donner in Los Angeles, but as far as a nationwide movement, it's been around for several years, and I think women finally started waking up and really vocalizing their desire for more education about themselves. Why it was suppressed for so long, I don't really know, except there's always been a subculture of women swapping information about themselves in relation to their reproductive organs, whether or not it was accurate information or not. Women pretty much have always taken care of their own needs when there wasn't professional medical help available or when professional medical help wasn't meeting their needs. For centuries there have been midwives and there have been unfortunately or fortunately, amateur abortionists among women themselves, or they've swapped methods that they thought were abortificants, whether they were in fact or not. I guess that's about it.
Of course, it goes back even further historically, well, not further than midwifery, but
yes.
Margaret Sanger, I suppose, would be called one of the first people who was at least interested in the health of women when she saw what was occurring with multiple pregnancies and with no opportunity for contraception, and the long, hard fight that she had to introduce this method respectably into the medical armamentarium, which today, of course, is a perfectly accepted part of medical treatment. And the same thing is true of the concern for rights over one's own reproductive tract as relates to choices in pregnancy, as many of you have certainly been involved in pregnancy counseling.
I think that one of the things that happened with Margaret Sanger is that when she was trying to get contraception advanced by the medical profession, I remember a quote of one of the doctors that she talked to who said he had no intention of letting women take care of their own reproduction because, after all, then he'd be putting himself out of work.
I think that this is a recurring theme in some of the literature I've been reading about self-help, about the primarily male physician who assumes control, and more people appear to be questioning his right to control. I read an article concerning a doctor in the Southwest who conducted a test of the oral contraceptive pill by giving poor Mexican-American women, half of them he gave just sugar pills, and they assumed they were taking an oral contraceptive, and out of 76, 10 became pregnant. And this, I've heard things such as this tend to undermine a woman's confidence in her male physician.
Well, it isn't just, I don't know how to phrase this exactly, but it's the way we have been trained in medicine rather than just the male physician. And it appears that way because there are more male physicians than there are females. But it always has been to, you know, in a sense, be in control of what the condition is. On the other hand, you exploiting that control for, quote, scientific reasons, as in the case of the placebo given to the Mexican-American women, that's pretty much playing around with people's lives. And whether a female physician or a male physician would do this in the interest of science mm-hmm. would be hard to, you know, to sort out. But the matter of the fact is that the majority of the physicians are male, and this has done a lot, you know, to legitimize some other problems that women have. For instance, just the concept of menstruation as a disability.
Yes.
The profession has legitimized that when all of us know, and most women know, somewhere, that it's a normal physiological, biological process, which in many cultures is a celebrated occasion and never considered a disability, much less days off work, etc. And so I guess many women live up to the expectancy of this being a disabling period. And consequently, we still have physicians who write excuses so girls don't have to take gym or whatever, which wouldn't occur to them if they had a young man with a mild disability, try to get him some kind of physical activity, because it's very important. Quotes to boys, but part of our bodies, I think, too, is the excitement of using it. And I think women have been denied this opportunity.
Well,
in a number of areas.
Nicholas Van Hoffman, a liberal columnist for the Washington Post, commented on this study with the Mexican-American women and drew a conclusion a little bit different than yours that I'd like for you to comment on, Evie. He was saying that the thing that distressed him about this study was that the doctor was trying to show that fertility was all in a woman's head rather than in her uterus. If she thought she was protected, she would not become pregnant. He was equating this with the idea that in many medical textbooks, menstrual pain it's all part of being a high-strung woman. It's all emotional. Labor pains are natural, and women overemphasize them, and doctors are supposed to hold screaming women in disdain. And von Hoffman was taking the point of view that male physicians have not been taking women's physiology serious enough by attributing it all to their, quote, overactive emotional structure.
Well, I think that's, you know, that may be how the profession often reacts. At the same time, telling women that this is a normal physiological process could have stopped a lot of that emotionalism. And that's what I meant by legitimizing the fact that these pains occur, rather than saying, or rather than helping a woman to understand that it's a normal process, where this could reduce some of the anxiety and some of the quote, psychological pain.
I think there's also another side to that coin, and that is the physician who has a patient who's actually in distress with her periods, who may pass a lot of clots or something and is in quite a bit of pain, and writes her off as saying, you know, this it's in your head if this period is bothering you that much. That's another thing I think that Nicholas von Hoffman mentioned, was a study that some people had done on asking physicians what they thought about periods, whether they thought periods were painful or not, and also studying some of the medical texts and the way the attitude that the textbooks had about menstrual periods were that you know, they weren't that painful. And so for the woman who does have some pain involved in it, sometimes she can go to a doctor who assumes that she's pretty much faking it. And so I think that both of these, there's problems on both of these sides, and I think that one of the things that has to be done is that women have to understand that it is a natural process. But I also think that the same way that doctors need to become sensitive to their patients and to understand that, you know, some people do have pain involved with menstrual periods.
Well, this is what I try to do, because I think you're right. They're both of these sides have something to them. And again, it comes back to the consumer's knowledge. If your understanding is, if an individual's understanding is that the menstrual, you know, period is a normal physiological process and should not cause discomfort, and as a matter of fact, the more active they are, the less apt they are to have difficulty. But that when there is difficulty, when there is pain, it's enough to cause a day home from work, a day home from school, or vomiting. And they pass it off, women do too, and say, well, that's, you know, what's supposed to happen. Or some physician says, well, you know, that's the way it is. They really need to demand, should demand, a full examination.
Mm-hmm.
And so it really happens on both sides, that women expect that this is okay, if this is what's supposed to happen. So they don't seek care. On the other hand, when they do seek care, somebody tells them, well, you know, it's pretty normal, so forget it.
Yeah.
And don't give them a full examination. And I won't mention the university, but I did have an opportunity to review 160 freshman women records. And the menstrual history was what my daughter calls hair raising. You know, just terrific pain, disability, irregularity, etc. in the history. And then when it came to the physical exam, where the physician had to write whether or not the historical elements were pursued, came to pelvic, not indicated.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have a lot of educating of ourselves to get done,
mm-hmm.
which is a great reluctance on the part of the medical profession to examine young women.
Mm-hmm. I think that also something that's kind of contributed to this is that since the women's movement has a lot of opponents as well as proponents, some doctors have been determining that when women have problems with their menstrual periods or when women have problems with pregnancies, that they are rejecting their role as a woman. And I think that it's sort of a reactionary thing that's gotten worse since the women's movement has become more active. I myself have had some run-ins with some physicians on this basis, determining that the reason I had any kind of gynecological problems was because I was a woman's liver, and therefore I was rejecting my role.
Yes. I think I could quote Van Hoffman on this. This was something that I underlined in his article. He was discussing the concept of morning sickness, which he says that more than 3/4 of all pregnant women experience morning sickness in some either a mild or severe form.
Mm-hmm.
He says there is good reason to suspect it is caused by a hormonal substance called estrogen. But in the medical literature, you can read that nausea in pregnancy, quote, may indicate resentment, ambivalence, and inadequacy in women ill-prepared for motherhood,
mm-hmm.
end quote.
Yep. I think that that's a really important part of the healthcare service that's pretty much, I don't think that it's stressed very much in medical schools, is the attitude that physicians should be taking toward patients. A lot of times medical ethics and things are taught, but the attitudes between the physicians and the patients isn't stressed that much.
That leads me to something else. It seems that so far we've kind of established on a golden mean as an ideal, an informed woman and a responsive physician. How do we get either or both? What do we do now here?
There are a number of things developing, I think. Of course, in our bodies ourselves, there's really a checklist for a woman to determine the type of physician that she might wish to choose by finding out what tests he offers, whether or not there's the opportunity to meet with a physician prior to examination period so that there's an opportunity to discuss with him sort of eyeball to eyeball what her feelings and perhaps presenting complaint may be, or she may even be there for routine examination and will be able to say, I am one of the women who would like to have the kind of an examination in which, you know, we learn all about what's going on with me, and you help me do this. And she become confident enough to do it. At least that's one part of what some of the self-help groups are doing, developing a checklist that a woman can really use. And I hope we would develop it for all patients. At the same time, I think we have to begin at the other end in medical education to alert ourselves, both as teachers and working with students, that this is the way the world is going to be. But it isn't going to be easy, I agree with you. It's not going to come tomorrow.
When I would like to see self-help worked more into public clinics instead of being just a function of a small university community and having educated university people, I think probably even more, especially women who are having children, who have had children, need this type of education. So I'd really like to see it self-help brought into free clinics in this area or public health clinics as it is in other parts of the country.
Dr. Yandell, do you think that's feasible?
Yes, I think this is something that family planning clinics are a pretty good setting for this type of thing, perhaps not during the evening of the clinic when patients are there for particular services, but to offer group meetings with nurse clinicians on an alternate evening when women can come in and see the kinds of slides and have, in a sense, the establishment, not just public health clinics, but in other states it's Planned Parenthood clinics, where they are related to family planning, but there's no reason why they shouldn't be related to total female health, and that this would be one part of what's offered in some physicians' offices as well as in clinic settings. A kind of educational program, a participatory education, mm-hmm. And this is going to require the instruction and a learning process for everybody concerned, both the educator, in this case perhaps the physician, nurse, clinician, as well as the learner, the consumer.
Well, we've explored the ideal a little bit. I'd like to push you a little bit and find out where your boundaries are. What is the extent of self-help? Some of the articles I've read as talking about a resurgence in the midwife, and having communities of women who help one another deliver their babies at home. This to me seems like it might not be a practical extension, but at least a logical extension of the concept of self-help. Where do you draw the line?
Well, I think that midwifery would require more training than just a four-session self-help clinic. I think that for women with who have their uteruses in the normal position and who do see a physician or at least a paramedic who has a real knowledge of what's happening during the pregnancy, I think that probably midwifery can be a part of the medical services. I think that sometimes though emergencies arise during birth, which I think that there has to be a hospital accessible. So,
well, many states do license nurse midwives,
uh-huh.
And part of that is to relieve the shortage in the hospital primarily. Some countries, such as England, you don't see a physician unless you really have some kind of a complication. Mm-hmm. And you're delivered in a lovely nursing home rather than in a hospital with all the sterile trappings. And the physician is on call if he's needed, and it does have all of the necessary equipment for an emergency.
Yeah.
But the setting, the milieu, is quite different. And the opportunity for rooming in, for husbands to be present, this kind of thing, is part of a number of other medical cultures. It has not been a part of the culture, the medical culture in the United States, in recent years.
Although I think that there's
a movement back, I believe.
Yeah, I think there is a midwife training school in Tennessee.
There's quite
several.
A few around
yeah.
the country,
yeah.
But unfortunately, midwives aren't recognized legally in Kansas, so we can't make use
yeah.
of them here yet. But I think there definitely is a movement toward more people are interested in becoming midwives and more people are interested in using the services of midwives as opposed to just having an obstetrician there when they're delivered. A midwife can frequently work with the mother through her prenatal period and be with her more of the time throughout labor and delivery instead of just showing up at the time when delivery occurs, and also see the mother afterwards. In many rural and also urban inner city areas, the midwife is sort of a combination obstetrician social worker. I really think that midwives can have a more of an important function in our society now.
Mm. The interesting part is how many men are going into nursing.
Yes, midwives.
Who are very sensitive to working with the patient. And on the other hand, if you've done home deliveries, I'm of the vintage that did deliver the last of the home deliveries at Charity Hospital in New Orleans. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a pretty scary experience. It's fine, as you say, when there's a normal delivery.
Mm-hmm.
But even with a patient who is not only having, quotes, a normal delivery, but is maybe on her fifth or sixth, the uterus can just decide to stop at some point in time, as I know you're aware. And that kind of an emergency simply cannot be handled either in the country, if you're doing a rural practice, unless you have all the equipment with you and have blood on hand, etc. And so consequently, that's been the move into bringing patients into the hospital. I brought all of my rural patients into the hospital to be delivered, simply because so many of them had more than one baby, and the more pregnancies, the more apt you are to have complications, and generally also this is true of the first pregnancy. So it's really for the protection of the mother, but it doesn't mm-hmm. have to also be all that sterile and all that institutionalized as it has become. That goes right along with women demanding and asking to be part of this marvelous process and be awake.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how many of my own colleagues, women, I've asked, what was your delivery like? And they don't remember because they were sound asleep.
Yeah.
And that period hopefully has diminished, but we use less anesthesia. But the self-prepared or prepared childbirth certainly could be aided by the midwife, who would have more time.
Mm.
Be more available.
Okay, it sounds as if we have agreement at that extreme. Let's move it back a little bit to a procedure that is attracting a lot of attention, at least in the popular press at this point, the menstrual extraction, which is, correct me if I'm wrong in the technical details, basically it's a suctioning out of the contents of a woman's uterus up until the point where her menstrual period would be 10 days late, so that the contents of the uterus, whatever they might be, a beginning pregnancy or just a delayed menstrual period, the contents are sectioned out. This menstrual extraction has been described as a fairly simple procedure. Physicians across the country are beginning to perform it in their offices, and some of the self-help groups are doing this also. What's your feeling on this? Is this too extreme for the concept of self-help, or is it a very viable part of it?
Well, I think that with the proper training, and I want to stress that, that paraprofessionals can do menstrual extractions. But I also feel that the medical profession is finally becoming partially sensitive to this area, and they're finally opening up a little bit. And I think that it should be something that, and like Dr. Gendel said earlier, if the medical profession keeps their doors closed to women in areas such as this, then women will do it themselves. And I think that for a woman to be able to get a kit and to do an extraction on herself with no training, with no one with her, is dangerous. So I feel like that at this point, I'm really hoping that more doctors are going to start doing this, and that the price goes down. I think it's such a simple procedure. It doesn't need to be as expensive as it is now here in Lawrence or in Kansas City. But I do think that it's dangerous for women to try that on themselves when they've had no training.
Well, even if it weren't dangerous, because you'll see several articles, those that are pro, those that are con, about whether or not the soft tip of a Carmen cannula can go
infection
and penetrate through a uterus, or even cause infection, both of which have already happened, so that it can occur even with the best of training. The real concern is that just by doing menstrual extraction, because a period is late, there are several other things that are necessary. The patient may have other pelvic pathology, and you aren't going to find that by just doing a menstrual extraction. Mm-hmm. A late period can be due to a lot of different things. Primarily a late period in a person who's not ordinarily regular and who's been exposed to pregnancy, obviously, is pregnancy. So evacuating the uterus within 10 days is an excellent concept. But at the same time, the entire pelvis needs an examination because it may be some ovarian problem. There may be an ovarian cyst. There can be anything else that may have caused this delayed period. And with the tendency not to examine the contents and send them to a pathologist, mm-hmm. The opportunity to miss a mole or a tumor, an early growth, is another part of the danger. Plus, it's such a poor health education experience.
Oh, definitely.
Because it's like taking a drop of blood and only doing one test on that drop of blood when you could do 30 on the same drop of blood and mm-hmm. give the patient that much more information. Mm-hmm. You're simply doing a menstrual extraction and hoping that that's the problem and that it is a pregnancy and perhaps missing four other things. The patient not having the opportunity to know that a full pelvic could be done at the same time and should be done. I don't think anyone does a menstrual extraction in their office or in the hospital without a complete pelvic and a pap smear, etc.
At least know the doctors that I refer people to.
All right, well, to sum up then, what can we conclude are the basic benefits of the self-help movement at this time in America?
Well, for one thing, I think it's improving the quality of health of the women who participate in it because of increased awareness of their own bodies and of changes in their bodies, things that indicate health and things that indicate illness or disease. I think it's making more educated consumers out of women and therefore keeping the medical profession on its toes a little more and maybe changing some medical practices like lowering the cost of abortions so that women don't have to resort to performing abortions on themselves because they can't afford to go to a doctor. What else can you think of, Cher?
I agree. I just think that the general awareness, the level of awareness, is going up. I think that's the most important part of the self-help movement is to, sort of aid that upward motion of the awareness.
Well, I'm encouraged by the same thing. I tend to feel a little bit like Janice does, that it's going to be a while before this becomes universal. And consequently, those of us in the profession who are already working in medicine ought to be providing more opportunities for physicians to get together to discuss the problem together and what they're going to do about it. There is a group called the Institute for the Advancement of the Study of the Humanities in Obstetrics and Gynecology. 150 gynecologists who recently met to have other people look at the profession through non-rose-colored glasses, and some of us were privileged to participate in that kind of a conference. Perhaps more like that will increase that awareness.
Mm-hmm. All right. I would like to thank our guests Sue Leminska, Sharon Lee, and Evelyn Gundell for tonight's very informative discussion on self-help. I'd like to invite all of you to listen again next week when our topic will be divorce, and the program is A Feminist Perspective.